Just this past summer, the San Francisco Board of Education passed a vote to cover up a mural of George Washington in one of the schools, a mural that was commissioned by the U.S. government under the New Deal art program in 1936 and was painted by a well-known artist, Victor Ornatoff, who died in 1979. It was painted using the fresco technique on wet plaster, meaning it was permanently put on that wall. So when the Board of Education decided to remove it, or at least cover it up, they had to figure out what were the means in order to do that. The reason they were trying to cover it up or voted to cover it up and not let it be exposed or shared with the world anymore was for two reasons. One, it depicted Native Americans that had died with people standing around in a look of celebration. And then it also depicted slaves. And it's amazing, and if we look back on our history, I know for me, George Washington lived in history as a deity, and I remember the first time that I realized he was a slave owner and had to wrestle with that on the inside of what that meant for me and my understanding of this person that I really believe was an honorable man that led our country well in the beginning. And it's kind of hard to say that knowing that this man that was born in Virginia in 1732, when his father died at the age of 11, he inherited 10 slaves from his father, inherited people from his father. In those days in Virginia, the institution of slavery was considered a given. And slaves, like land and other property, could be bought, they could be sold, they could be given away, rented out, and also, of course, passed down as a part of an inheritance. And really, as a Virginia man, George Washington was no different than others. When Lin-Manuel wrote his play and began to assemble a cast, one of the things they had to wrestle with, particularly for Christopher Jackson, who played the role of Washington, and others playing roles of Thomas Jefferson, people that they looked up to, they had to wrestle with the fact that these men, these African-American actors, were portraying men who were, in history, slave owners. When George Washington married Martha Washington, it more than doubled the number of his slaves. And in 1759, there were about 40 slaves living at Mount Vernon. Although Washington had control over most of those, they were not all his property. I share all that to say that obviously some of these people in our history that have become deities to us in our history often found themselves on the wrong side of issues in history. We can hope, as Washington said in his farewell address, we can hope in his knowledge and understanding, and most biographers agree that the farewell address signals his change on slavery and his relationship with Alexander Hamilton, who was very much a voice against slavery and very much an abolitionist, that we can believe when he says, "I know I have committed many errors," that one of those is his position and his history with slavery. Washington did make provisions in his will to free all of his own slaves, and by Virginia law, the ones that came with Martha could not be freed, but by freeing his slaves, he set an example for others to follow, and he was the only one of the founding fathers that did that. So, if we did any of our history, obviously we have to question, does this rule him out as good man category? And Christopher Jackson, who played the role of George Washington, said beautifully about a question about that. How do you comprehend playing the role of a man like this with this kind of stain on his history? And Christopher Jackson said, because I'm playing the role, and one day people are going to look back on me and the stains on my history. We are all human beings, and we're all working through this together. And a lot of celebration in the fact that toward the end of his life, at least he got some of those things right. It is a big responsibility to be given the kind of power that George Washington was given at a very young age, very young age. And it wasn't always power that he wanted. It wasn't always power that he sought after. When he showed up to the Constitutional Convention in 1787, he wasn't wanting to be in charge of anything, but he also wasn't wanting this country that he believed was so important to fall apart, and so he stepped into the role. And in the beginning, he did not seek out the presidency, but it was asked of him to serve. And most people believe about Washington that from the time he was a messenger in the French Indian War, he constantly just kept saying yes to things that he didn't want to do from the age of 25 on. That he felt a sense of duty and a sense of call to service. In that day and age when the president was elected, there really wasn't an idea that there would be a president in our country. We were recovering from the relationship with King George, and so we didn't want to have any kind of head of state with that kind of executive power. But the president election was held, and he received a vote from each elector and became the first president in American history, responsible in his first term for building the executive branch, naming Alexander Hamilton as the Secretary of Treasury, and Thomas Jefferson as the Secretary of State, and building the framework of the country that we know today. In the beginning, the U.S. president had no term limits. There was nothing in the Articles of Confederation that gave any term limits, and believe it or not, many believed that the role of president, because of George Washington, should be a lifetime appointment. Now, just let that linger right now for you. Doesn't that feel painful just to think about right now? A lifetime appointment for anyone holding the office. Whew. No worries. We got that fixed a little bit later. FDR exposed that lack of an addressing that issue, and we addressed it with an amendment to the Constitution. But one of the things that Lin-Manuel captures in this song that we shared this morning and the part of the play in Hamilton, that it was an outlandish thing of what George Washington did. It was not understandable by the king in England why he would do such a thing. He was terrified of George Washington and his leadership ability. Hamilton did not want it to happen. He was one of those strong voices that said it should be a lifetime appointment, and for him, his relationship to George Washington was more like a father to a son than a president to a secretary of treasury. But George Washington knew that for the country to thrive, he had to relinquish his power. Relinquish his power. Can you imagine someone being willing to relinquish their power? That is not something a king does. It's not something that someone who seeks out power does for themselves, but to relinquish power. Some seek power as the be-all and the end-all, wanting to feel powerful. They bully people. They set agendas with the central goal of just remaining in power, not any other agenda. The question is always, how does this benefit me, and how can I maintain this power that I have? And history has shown us over and over again two things. One, those type of people tend to rise to powerful positions because they work hard at it. And history has also shown us over and over again that when a narcissist rises to a position of power, a wave of destruction then follows in the path. I've been watching the History Channel documentary on Caligula, and Caligula was not quite 25 years old when he took power in Rome in the year 37. At first, his succession was welcomed in Rome and celebrated. They believed that he was going to be a great change and lead in the direction of the modern Rome that they envisioned for their empire. He announced all kinds of political reforms, and he recalled all the exiles. And it's amazing, in the first couple of years, if you think about this, when we hear the name Caligula and then his son Nero, we just kind of cringe, like, that's, oh, wow. We have words that just have become a part of these emperors, like Draco. Draconian laws are based on the fact of how we understand those unjust laws that he gave down. But can you imagine celebrating Caligula? Maybe you can. But Caligula believed that he was going to make Rome a place that thrived and moved into an even greater era in his life. In October of the year 37, he suffered an illness that turned him inward and created a fearful place for him, leading him to spend the remainder of his reign really exploring the worst parts of his nature. He lavished money on building projects, from the practical things like the aqueducts and the harbors to theaters and temples, and then some bizarre things that he created. He created a marble palace to his horse that he loved, even though many were impoverished in the city of Rome. He requisitioned a 2-mile floating bridge across the Bay of Bauli so he could spend 2 days galloping back and forth across that floating bridge. He led military campaigns to the Rhine and the English Channel, where he created battles just for theatrical displays and told his troops to plunder the seas and gather seashells for their helmets. His relationships with other individuals were turbulent as well. He tormented high-ranking senators by making them run for miles in front of his chariot. He had affairs with wives of his allies. He had so many incestuous relationships in his own family. And his biographer, Suetonius, says that he had a phrase that he repeated often. He said, "Remember," these are the words of Caligula, "remember, I have the right to do anything to anybody, and people will still love me and worship me." It is rumored that Caligula did say that he could shoot some... No, I'm just kidding. He didn't say that. Sorry. We see abuse of power all the time like this, and history has a way of repeating itself over and over again. And we can often want, because we watch this, we think, I don't want to have any power. If this is power and power always corrupts, then why would I want to have any sense of power? For fear of anything being associated with those who have abused the power. When the truth is, you and I are placed in positions of power all the time. Whether you want it or not, people listen to what we're saying, which makes us have to be responsible for how we use that power in our lives. Power doesn't mean that you have to ascend to some kind of throne or some kind of political office. You have power as a parent in your life, and people are watching you. You have power, I have to remind my oldest daughter all the time, you have power as an older sibling. And a responsibility to those that are watching. We are giving power in different positions at work, whether you want them or not. And people look up to you and what you say, and you have power and ability. If you put something out there, people are listening and paying attention to the power that you have. We all have experiences of power in our lives. And Emilio would want me to say that, you know, if you want to use that power well, he is working on creating positions here on committees in our congregation. And we're going to have a committee fair coming up in April where you can actually exert some of that power and experience some of that power to do good in the work of the UUCC. And I don't say that as a joke, because having a position in a church and a responsibility on the board or a committee or leading one of the staff positions or doing the many auxiliary jobs around our congregation are powerful positions, in the sense that you have the ability to use that power in a responsible way to do some good. So we can't avoid it, so we might as well figure out how to have a relationship with power that is responsible and respects our values and our principles as you use. The dean of the Stanford Business School, Robert L. Joss, gave a speech about 10 years ago, and he made the bold statement then that leadership is not about power, it's always about responsibility. And he gave three things that leaders should always experience in their rise to power and focus on their responsibility. One is to earn trust by being trustworthy. Think about that. Think about the people that you know in positions of power today, and think about your own relationship with power. Is your first priority to earn trust by being trustworthy? The second one is very important, too. Be open to criticism without getting defensive, and learn from other people. And then the last one he gave is to remember that it's really not all about you at all. Earn trust, be open to criticism, remember that it's not all about you. I can't think of a better way to celebrate President's Day than to remember those are three things that are so important to the person that holds the office of president. And I don't think that I am hidden in my own belief, even if you don't share it, that our current president does not abide by those three principles in leadership. I don't experience trustworthiness. I don't experience one who's open to criticism without getting defensive. I don't experience him as one who remembers that it's not about you. So in celebration of African American History Month, on the eve of this President's Day, I'd like to celebrate and remember the last time this office of a president was held by a leader who did hold some of these responsibilities instead of power. I'd like to remember Barack Obama, a man who built trustworthy relationships on an international stage that earned him a Nobel Peace Prize. I'd like to remember the man that took great strides toward providing health care to all, making that a right for all. I'd like to remember the first African-American president in history, the man who did not believe global warming was a myth and led the country to quadruple the use of solar and wind energy during his presidency. I'd like to remember the man that bridged racial gaps and used language of humility and respect in conversations and led others to do the same. I'd like to remember the man who fought for the rights of the LGBTQ community by signing hate legislation, repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and rallying support for gay marriage, ultimately seeing the Supreme Court make all the bans on gay marriage unconstitutional in all 50 states in 2015. What a celebration. Was he perfect? No. Was he human? Yes. But in this time of what is often experienced by me with you as despair, we must remember that not all is lost. Remember the goodness. Remember the greatness of the not too distant past. And remember that you are powerful. We are not hopeless and helpless in our world that we are living in. You are powerful. And as long as we are committed to love, committed to honoring the web of existence on our earth, to respecting, including, and affirming each other's worth, we are not only seeking out and speaking truth to power, but we are powerful beings. And we, even in this day and age, because of you, are not lost.